after church on a Sunday, we were walking down Lexington Avenue, and this woman was grumbling at, I think, me for blocking the sidewalk or something like that with my daughter in the stroller, and muttered as she stormed past us, like, go back to China or go back to your country or something like that. And I was just like stunned, and I sat there for a second, and then she kept going. And for some reason, I abandoned my daughter in her stroller and ran down the street, confronted her, and said, what, like, essentially, like, what did you say? And then she just started screaming, like, go back to China, go back to your country. And in my, I don't know, whatever was going through my brain, I was like, I was born in this country. It felt so silly.
You're listening to Rock the Boat, a show about Asian Americans who challenge the status quo. Our past guests have included Andrew Yang, Michelle Phan, Patrick Lee, and more. Our mission is to champion diversity in radio and elevate the voices of Asian Americans through storytelling. I'm your host, Lucia Liu. In 2016, Michael Luo wrote an open letter to the woman who shouted at him to, quote unquote, go back to China in the middle of the street on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It's a jarring experience, especially since Michael was born and raised in the United States. Michael led an investigative reporting team at the New York Times at that point, and he wrote an open letter under the coaxing of his coworkers. What was even more surprising was that the open letter he wrote wound up on the front page of the New York Times. That open letter soon generated an outpouring of other Asian Americans responding with similar experiences. One person tweeted, "Uncle car vandalized. Go back to China while parked in his own driveway in Dallas. I was 8. I cried a lot." Another person wrote, "Routinely asked, where are you from? Screamed at, chink! Where's the best Chinese restaurant? Ni hao. Konnichiwa." I, too, have personally experienced something similar when a woman yelled at me in front of her 8-year-old son. "You Asians are all the same," she said, after she got angry at me and my husband for taking some extra time with an object at a museum. And this was 2018, 2 years after Michael published his piece. Even today, as headlines surge with anti-Asian sentiments over the coronavirus, we see microaggressions and racism play out in our daily lives. But what is unique about Michael's story is that he has a platform to share his story and the power to really affect change. Michael had always wanted to affect policy and change, but he didn't expect it to be in the form of journalism. Prior to Rock the Boat, I've actually never heard of Michael since I wasn't a heavy Twitter user and I'm also not a subscriber to the Times. My co-host at the time, Lynn, actually reached out to him cold to come speak at our season 3 launch event, and luckily, he said yes. That is when I got to know Michael's story. Michael is thoughtful, warm, and highly intellectual. Better yet, there are also two of him. I invited Michael to our studio to tell his story.
So I have a twin brother. He was always better at math and science. I was better at English and social studies.
Is this a known thing? Are you guys identical twins?
So we are identical twins. We actually thought we were fraternal twins for most of our lives. Our parents thought we were fraternal twins. I think it had to do with...
Did you guys not look alike?
No, we actually look a lot alike. I mean, it has to do with, I think, at least from my mom's perspective, was there were two placentas. So basically they assumed that meant we were fraternal, but actually... You can be identical and have two placentas. What happened was, I remember I was in Arizona covering the Gabby Giffords mass shooting, and there was another reporter there, a New York Times reporter named Kirk Johnson, who had teenage twin sons, and we started to talk about this concept of twins who look a lot alike, and somehow it got to his sons, and they had thought they were fraternal, and then one day they took a DNA test and discovered they were identical. He told this whole story to me. I told my brother, and he was like, we should do a DNA test. Nothing happened. Nothing came of it. One day he just sent me one of those kits that you can get.
Was it 23andMe?
It might have been 23andMe. I think it probably was.
Okay.
And took the test, and I remember literally sitting there in the newsroom when I got this email, opening up the email and feeling this sort of sense of nervousness, and it said that you're identical. And it really changed our worldview, actually.
Michael and his brother were born in Pittsburgh. And then his family moved around New York until they ended up in Michigan, where he attended high school. His parents were born in China and moved to Taiwan before the Communist Revolution. They then came to the States for graduate school. His dad's an engineer and one of the people who actually pioneered the LCD display.
The one funny story involving a previous guest of yours is that my dad and Andrew Yang's dad knew each other and work in the same field, actually.
No way.
And they both worked at General Electric, GE's R&D center in Schenectady, New York.
That's funny.
Yes.
Did your parents ever expect you to be an engineer? Kind of follow in the footsteps of your dad?
So my parents weren't kind of the stereotypical Tiger parents, I think, in terms of like really forcing or pushing you to sort of be to a certain field or something like that. Sure, medicine was a field that was seen as prestigious and steady and things like that. And my dad was an engineer, and a lot of the people we knew were engineers. There was nobody that we knew who was a writer or a journalist or anything like that. I think like my parents' parenting style was they were very strict when we were young, and that kind of instilled certain kind of work habits in
right, like
my brother and I.
And,
And then we didn't need that much
handholding.
Yeah,
as
we got older, like it's not like we did our college applications ourselves and things like that.
Michael and his brother did well for themselves. They both ended up getting accepted to Harvard. Michael's brother chose economics and Michael chose government.
I was really interested in public policy, government, and changing the world kind of thing. I had that kind of idealistic worldview. And so I went to Harvard to study government. And that was mostly what I thought I was going to do.
Did you have a mind to go into politics?
So basically what happened was I thought, okay, I want to get into public policy. And what does that mean? And what does that look like?
And honestly, I actually
kind of struggled over like, what did it look like? What did it mean? As in like, oh, do you go work as a legislative aide in Congress? Or do you go work for HUD, you know, in some sort of, you know, management program, remember? Or do you go work at the State Department? I did a summer internship, actually, at the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency.
How was that? Can we talk about that? Is this confidential or no?
It was on my resume at some point.
Because I didn't find that on your LinkedIn profile.
It was a summer internship. I was an analyst in the Directorate of Intelligence. You had to pass a very extensive security clearance process. I had top secret clearance, and I wrote reports. And I actually thought about it at some point
that
as a career.
Did you enjoy your time there?
Yeah, I mean, it was. When you're an analyst, you're essentially sort of synthesizing bits of intelligence that come in, whether it's signals intelligence, human intelligence, things like that, And it's actually not unlike journalism, as in like areas.
Yeah,
like you cover certain areas and
a lot like investigative reporting in
a
certain way.
Yeah, I mean this was all harkening back to college, but the pinnacle of my summer was writing a sentence. They called it a snowflake. I think I remember is what it was called in the PDB, which is the President's Daily Brief. It was like a single sentence.
That sounds incredibly
that memo
hard
because that, how that, are, that the yeah. president gets every morning. So that was the pinnacle of my summer.
After graduating, Michael considered his career options. He would go down the so-called prestigious path into management consulting or finance, but the work didn't really interest him, and he still wanted to pursue public policy. He thought about returning to his job at the CIA, but he knew it wasn't a fit. He even took the LSATs and considered going to law school, but he quickly realized that he was more interested in studying law than practicing law. So after some introspection, Michael decided to give journalism a shot. He had worked at the Crimson at Harvard, which is the Harvard newspaper, and separately, he even started a magazine called Diversity and Distinction while he was at Harvard.
That was a magazine that was focused on minority issues. And so I had some background and interest in journalism. And so I just sort of thought like I could try this and at minimum would be an interesting adventure.
Michael ended up joining a rotational program at the LA Times called the Minority Editorial Training Program. That's where employees in the program would work for the Times for a year and then rotate to some other papers owned by the LA Times. After his stint at the LA Times, he moved over to Newsday. It was a good experience for Michael, but not necessarily one that he expected.
Actually, I say that I got into journalism at first not because of a love of the craft and the love of writing, although that is very much one of the reasons I love it today. And I tell young writers and aspiring journalists that they have to love the craft. But when I first started in journalism, it was because of what journalism could do. As in, like, I had this sort of idealistic, you know, a little social justice sort of oriented sort of side that I wanted to change the world, make the world better. And that's why I got into journalism. And then I realized my first couple of years at the LA Times and at Newsday, my job when I was at Newsday was the Suffolk County Cops Beat, which was in Suffolk County. I covered police, law enforcement.
That sounds like a great way to change the world.
Yes. And so you're not really, so a lot of what I was doing was writing about crime, about people who were murdered. Actually, one of the things I did a lot of at Newsday as the Suffolk County Cops Reporter is the Newsday covered every single fatal car accident in Long Island.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's depressing.
Yeah. So
that gets
there's a thing in journalism where they call it the slug of the story, and it's just the way that a story is labeled in the content management system. And so I wrote many stories that were slug LI, which is Long Island, FATA, FATA, short for fatal, LI FATA, and then there would be the date, like LI FATA 12. And so I just wrote so many of those stories, and essentially those are almost like obituaries.
Right.
Like, and I would say I was kind of a professional obituary writer. So the thing that I learned in journalism quickly is that a lot of what journalism is actually just writing about what happened. And there is no moral valence, or you're not changing anything.
As you were talking about writing slugs and writing about deaths and being the official obituary writer for that newspaper, were there ever times when you just got fed up with it? Mm-hmm. Were there ever times where you felt like you would quit? Mm-hmm.
I remember having like conversations with my twin brother about like, you know, what we were each doing and do we like it? Is this what we want to do? And I actually remember talking about like, what is the kind of overarching purpose of, if I were to try to think of a purpose for like writing that fatal car accident story. And it was my brother actually who said, you're giving dignity to these people's lives, these people who have died. And I like that. Yeah. So that's what I was trying to do.
Michael worked through his LI FATAs, but the silver lining is that during his downtime, he was also able to work on some narrative stories. His work in narrative storytelling is what ultimately gave him his big break.
So I was covering Suffolk County cops on Long Island and for a Newsday, and I did it for 2.5 years. I was writing my LI FATAs, and I moved from there to a job as a national writer in a little department at the Associated Press called the News Features Department, where they concentrated on writing sort of narrative feature stories. I don't really know why they hired me. Everyone else on the team was much older.
Did you start already writing narrative stories at that point?
Right.
Did they see some of your work and think, oh, this guy might be really great for this team?
Yeah, yeah. And what happened was I think I applied for a different job and somehow got the attention of the editor of this team, and I had done some narrative type work at Newsday, and he saw some potential in that. I mean, to be honest, I think like what they were trying to do is kind of shake up the energy of the team and bring in sort of a young, energetic writer who probably came from a different background from a lot of the other folks, and sort of give the team a different, you know, dynamic. And so that was a big opportunity.
This is where Michael's diverse background gave him an opportunity, and he took it. It was at the Associated Press, or AP as Michael calls it, where Michael's second big break came. Ironically, it was due to his coverage of 9/11. Michael's girlfriend at the time, now wife, worked downtown at Lehman Brothers.
I remember she called me and she was like, the World Trade Center is I think like a plane flew into the World Trade Center, or it was like the World Trade Center on fire. Should I go to work? And I was like, I said, yes, as in like, cause like I was like, if like something happened, the World Trade Center is on fire, you work in the building next to it. There's nothing, you're still gonna go to work.
You know, half that building, like the windows blew out, yeah. And then I think half of American Express had to move to New Jersey during that period. So, it was insane.
Yeah, so she actually went, and but then the subway stopped short of the, they had closed the Chamber Street.
Yeah.
And so she came back, and I actually wound up. Because I was, what I was trying to do on 9/11 initially was to try and find the mayor, Rudy Giuliani, and so I just headed downtown. I was at his first press conference, which was in the 20s, like I think at the police academy down there. I remember stopping by my wife's apartment in Soho, and I was like, I have to go downtown. She's like. And I,
she's like, you're crazy.
Yeah, this it was like this melodramatic and moment, and like, it's my job, you know, kind of moment. And
kind of like a hero at that point. Like, I just see,
I mean, it's
you,
silly.
Like,
it's silly.
You're like Clark Kent, yeah, and you just gotta.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing where like there were no cabs going, and you getting in a cab and be like, take me downtown. I'll pay you whatever money that, you know, that.
The cabbie's like, you're crazy. Yeah, exactly. Not going there.
Exactly. And so I ended up, you know, basically spending the next couple of days just down there. And my big thing on 9/11, that my contribution to the AP's coverage was I bumped into a union official from the fire department who was walking around in all the sort of smoke and craziness. And I asked him how many people they thought they lost. And I think he said they thought it was 400 or 500. And they put that on the AP wire as a bulletin, citing this union official. And it turned out to be very close. I think it was like the fire department lost just under 400 people. And I just spent the next couple of months writing a lot of stories, narrative type stories about 9/11. I wrote a piece about, I think the headline was "Widowed Before She Became a Bride," and it was about a woman who,
oh wow, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, whose fiance had passed away, and I wrote a story about the fire department's football team, which had lost all these people, and I wrote about Fred Alger Management, which was a firm that was on the 93rd floor of the World Trade Center, and so those were a lot of the stories that I wrote in my early days at the AP.
Michael would go on to write more groundbreaking stories, and slowly he started to see his stories change policies. Michael recounts one of his most impactful stories.
I wrote a series about three poor, kind of mentally challenged, low IQ African Americans who were in prison in Alabama for killing a baby that probably never existed. And so it was a kind of a false confession type of situation. And the series ended up resulting in two out of three of them being freed from prison. One of them stayed in prison on some separate charges. That series that I wrote about them ended up winning a couple of big awards, the George Polk Award and the Livingston Award for Young Journalists, which is a big award for journalists under the age of 35.
Right.
That led to opportunities. And so what ended up happening was I ended up having offers to go back to the LA Times or go to the New York Times. Mm. And it's silly and it's crazy now to think about it, but back then it was a real choice. LA Times was an amazing newspaper. And I was seriously considering it. I ended up going to the New York Times and as a Metro reporter.
As an investigative reporter, Michael covered issues surrounding gun laws, presidential candidates, and he and his team also broke important stories that changed policies.
As an investigative reporter and investigative editor, you have the sort of freedom to pick and choose stories and invest lots and lots of time. One of the most amazing things about that is you do stories that change things and change laws. And,
right,
and
right.
You know, when I was a deputy metro editor at the New York Times and I started and ran a team of investigative reporters, I ran Mike Schwartz and Mike Weinrip, who were the two reporters that really broke open stories about brutality and corruption at Rikers Island, the jail mm-hmm. in Rikers Island, mm-hmm. and also later about horrible things that were happening in New York State prisons. And for me, like a good investigative target is if there are lives at stake, if it affects a lot of people, if there's opportunity to change something, change a law, put somebody in jail. The other thing I would say too, that's like a very powerful is I worked on investigative stories on presidential campaigns, and I feel like that is a really important civic responsibility of vetting people who might become president.
So at this point, Michael was finally affecting policy through his work. He was making an impact, he was leading a team of investigative reporters, and he was working his dream job. Then what happened next was what Michael calls a complete anomaly, a stroke of fate.
So the backstory was that it was after church on a Sunday. We were walking down Lexington Avenue, and this woman was grumbling at I think me for blocking the sidewalk or something like that with my daughter in the stroller, and muttered as she stormed past us, like, go back to China or go back to your country or something like that. And I was just like stunned, and I sat there for a second, and then she kept going, and for some reason I abandoned my daughter in her stroller and ran down the street, confronted her, and said, what, like, essentially, like, what did you say? And then she just started screaming at me, like, go back to China, go back to your country. And in my I don't know, whatever was going through my brain, I was like I was born in this country. It felt so silly, and I started tweeting about what happened, because, like, there was this sort of feeling of the adrenaline obviously was there, but, like, there was this sort of feeling of just sadness that something like this could still happen in 2016.
Well, the fact that you led an investigative journalism team for the New York Times, and you've uncovered so many things with the country, and you've changed so many, I think, outcomes of people mm-hmm. within America mm-hmm. that, I mean, it's arguable that you're more American than she is, right? Like, it's arguable that you've done more things for America than she has in an odd certain way. Right. And I can just imagine the fury that you had inside when you heard something like that mm-hmm. because you're like, oh, I'm mm-hmm. I belong here just as much as you.
And it was an element of, you know, what do I have to do, you know, to belong, kind of thing. Obviously, belonging in this country is not about, like, your accomplishments or anything like that, your resume or anything like that. You know, the way our country's laws work are, if you're born in this country, you're a citizen of the United States and with the same rights and recognition as anybody, no matter your accomplishments. But yes, in that moment, I was like, what do I have to do? And there was this sort of feeling of sadness and just weariness, and also just thinking about my daughter and whether she would feel like she belonged in this country. And so I ended up sort of tweeting about this, and this hashtag, this is 2016. It just started to accelerate. I remember it was Bill de Blasio. Bill de Blasio, like, retweeted one of my tweets about it, and he said something along the lines of, like, you belong, or something like that, to me, you know. So, you know, Michael, you belong. So then I ended up writing a piece. The reason why I ended up doing it was I was an editor on, besides being an investigative editor, the Times had a kind of a cross-desk race team that was an initiative around covering race, and I edited a reporter, Rachel Swarns, who's on that team, and several people on the team, including Rachel and I think Mark Lacey, who ran the team, who's now the national editor at the Times, were emailing me and saying, I think you should write about this. And I think it was Mark who suggested, why don't you do it as an open letter to this woman? And I was like, okay, I'll try that. I was actually a little skeptical that it would work, but I wrote it that way and published it, and it just took off. And so then the next day, it became a viral piece on the internet.
It really hits home.
Yeah.
It really hits home because it just feels like, oh, we've been here for so many years and we still don't feel like we belong.
Yeah. And so the thing that happened was the next day, the Times has a meeting where it's a morning meeting where they talk about the news of the day, and there's also starting to plan the front page of the newspaper. And so we started talking about this my piece, and they said, oh, well, let's put it in print. Because actually, I thought it was just going to run online. And I was like, oh, okay, we can stick it in the back of the metro section or something like that. And then eventually, by the end of the day, at like 4:30, a decision was made to publish it on the front page of the New York Times.
How did you feel?
I mean, it was in retrospect, that decision was such a giant sort of decision and made the piece, because it was not just because it was an extraordinary moment because of the subject matter, the fact that it has to do with Asian Americans and belonging. It's very unusual to have that written about on the front page of the New York Times.
But it's also the fact that it happened to you, and you're one of them, right? Like you're
right.
It
was a first person piece, and it was written as an open letter. It was very unusual. It's a very unusual decision, and that led to, I mean, this is the modern New York Times, but there was what ended up happening was, because there was so much response, they started asking other Asian Americans, has this ever happened to you? And people started tweeting about it with this hashtag, this is 2016. And our video team, the video team of the New York Times, started reaching out to these people and turned around this incredibly powerful direct-to-camera video of people telling their stories, Asian Americans telling their stories of these kinds of things happening to them. That video went viral, and then it led to, we held an online forum, and it just sort of became this thing. And it became such a big deal that I remember I was like at Barnes & Noble like shortly after all this, and somebody looked at me and it's like, wait, are you... that reporter at the New York Times? And it was so strange.
Prior to that moment, have you ever given thought about the Asian American community, about your identity, news, and how it relates, and print media, how it relates to Asian Americans?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I've thought a lot about race and ethnicity and identity. I started a magazine in college that had to do with it. But it was interesting because at that point, I got started to be invited to speak at a lot of places and be on panels about Asian Americans and race. And the interesting thing about it was, it's like, it's not like I'm a historian of Asian American history. You know, actually, since then, I've actually made a point of, you know, reading a lot, actually, about Asian American history. And I was suddenly made the face of Asian America for a while. And it was just a really surreal experience.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it feels a little bit like, you know, you were immersed in your work. You're doing a great job. People aspired to be you in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But race and ethnicity had never been at the forefront of your mind.
Yeah, I think so. And then since then, I moved to The New Yorker initially as an investigative editor on the print magazine. And this was another break, I think, was 3 months after I moved over to The New Yorker to be a magazine editor. Nick Thompson, who was the editor of NewYorker.com, overseeing the entire digital operation of The New Yorker, left to become the editor-in-chief of Wired. And they asked me to take this job. And subsequently, over the last 3 years, I've had the chance to oversee like a really big expansion in The New Yorker. Basically, what we're doing is taking The New Yorker from a weekly print magazine to a daily digital destination. As part of that, I actually sometimes get to write. And there have been moments when I've been able to revisit that subject. I kind of revisited what happened to me and talked a little bit about that feeling of otherness. And another opportunity, I wrote a column at one point about the Chinese Exclusion Act. And, you know, going back and reading the debates in Congress on the Senate floor about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the language that was used about these Chinese immigrants is really sad and stunning that this kind of language was spoken on the Senate floor.
We always have a signature question. This is a new one for season 4. It's, how do you intend to rock the boat?
So being a Asian American in a position of influence or semi-prominence, I think there is an element of what I'm working to be most is just an excellent editor and journalist, period. And that, to a certain extent, you would say potentially that that's a colorblind sort of perspective. On the other hand, that's unrealistic in terms of every person has background history, perspective, expertise, opinions, passions that are unique to them and that you bring as an editor. And I think sometimes I think I have to remind myself that it's not bad to bring that perspective that I particularly have as an Asian American, as an Asian immigrant, and other aspects of who I am, that it is, there's no one who is just an editor who is a blank slate. And that's something that I think I need to remind myself sometimes.
Thank you, Michael, for sharing your story and for doing the work that you do. It's not only great for the news and for public policy, but for other Asians who aspire to be like you someday. That was Michael Luo, editor of The New Yorker. Michael's story is interesting because it reminds me that no matter how far we've come, the question of race and belonging will always be with us. It's funny because Michael's career has come full circle in some ways. His career in journalism started because of a minority program at the LA Times. His investigative reporting helped him change the lives of many people, but also his open letter helped shed awareness around racism towards Asian Americans like himself. It's highly arguable that if Michael wasn't in the position that he was, and he wasn't encouraged by his own staff to publish the open letter, it would not have been written or published on the front page of the New York Times. And all the Asian Americans who responded to the letter wouldn't have a platform to share their stories and voice their concerns. As a community, we still have a really long way to go in terms of advocating for ourselves. Michael mentions that there just aren't a lot of Asians running media companies or in senior level positions within media companies. There's a few personal takeaways I got from interviewing Michael. One is that getting to a point where you can truly impact and make changes takes patience and perseverance. It took Michael 10 years to get to the Metro desk, where he was finally able to do the type of investigative reporting work that actually affected change and actually affected the public policy that he wanted to affect. It also takes some luck and a lot of skill. When Michael accepted his job at the Associated Press and jumped to cover 9/11, he put his own life on the line to rush to the scene and cover what happened that day. He was lucky to land the job at the Associated Press. He had the courage to put his life on the line to do his job, and he also had the skills to deliver solid pieces for the news agency. Finally, for me, I think the biggest takeaway is that as Asians, we can excel at our work. We can affect policy changes, we can do what we think is for the greater good, but we can't escape our heritage. It's deeply ingrained in how we view the world. Sure, the corporate world can train us to become blind to it. It can train us to tell our stories in a way that is acceptable to the masses, but it's undeniable that the world views us differently still. So instead of blending in and ignoring our race or our ethnicity, or our cultural heritage, how can we embrace it? And for those, as Michael mentions, who are in positions of influence, how can you leverage your Asian American perspective to help you do a better job and uplift our community? That is my challenge to you. Thanks for tuning in to Rock the Boat. There's a link to Michael's open letter from the New York Times in the show notes, along with a link to the video with responses from other Asian Americans on the piece. Please support the podcast by subscribing to it on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star rating if you're listening on iTunes, and definitely tell your friends about it. This episode was written and edited by me, Lucia Liu. Music mixing by Rachel Chu. Thank you to our new associate producer, David Liu. You can follow us on Instagram at RockTheBoatNYC and subscribe to our mailing list for inside news. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you all next time.